and drinks and smokes. And Rose's intrigue with Odalie at first is very much based on her severe disapproval of Odalie and her wanton ways. And it only gradually sort of transforms into obsession and a sort of intimacy of a kind.
I had seen enough. I was trembling with rage. I quickly turned on my heel and scurried away in the direction of the ladies' room, where for several minutes I retched nothing but air into an empty sink. Then I stood staring at my reflection in the mirror, and for a while, everything went black.
A lot of people don't find Rose to be a likable protagonist. It's kind of like one of those paradoxes. Protagonists, it always insinuates it's going to be somebody that you're going to root for. But I actually did find Rose sympathetic insofar that I wanted to know more about her, and when she would go into shady situations, I wanted to protect her almost. And so I was drawn to her mindset, her ways of sort of tricking herself into believing that she was always in the right, or that that if she did something that was somewhat transgressive, she had a very elaborate way of figuring out how to justify it. And so I was actually drawn to that only because I found that interesting and also very human. I think a lot of people do that without realizing that's what they're doing.
As soon as I stepped over the threshold, I felt the wall panel swing shut behind me. I pushed through the velvet curtain at the end of the hallway. I was unprepared for the scene that awaited me.
Odalie I was drawn to in a completely opposite way, because I allowed her to be a little bit more of an abstract figure in the book. In my mind, she was kind of more of a female Great Gatsby, where he shifts and moves. You don't really know who that character is, and I wanted her to be that so that Rose is really developing through Odalie. Odalie's more of a lens than she is a fully formed character in my mind.
The author Suzanne Rendell discussing the central characters in her story, The Other Typist, Radio 4 Extra's book at Beach Time from Monday afternoon onwards at 2:30. And for more exclusive Book at Beach Time content, you can go to the BBC Radio 4 Extra website.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, Jim Lee here with the 60-minute drama that takes us back to 1946, where secret events are unlocked when scriptwriter Gregory Dawson rediscovers characters from his past. In the 4 o'clock show, Mel Gedroych gets spooked by scary sounds, hears about the lady who dived into glass tanks, and has the final part of David Ullman's story, The Boy Who Swam with Piranhas. And at 8 o'clock, we're concluding the chilling tale of post-war Germany Fatherland, the story that saw the Nazis win the war. First, we have the concluding part of Bright Day by J.B. Priestley. The disillusioned scriptwriter Gregory Dawson is remembering his youth in 1912, before the slaughter of the First World War, when he was an 18-year-old in Yorkshire. Now, in 1946, encounters with the same characters from his past unlock secret events, buried yearnings, and give potential for the future.
Previously.
It was June 1946, and I'd come here to the Royal Ocean Hotel in Cornwall to finish writing a script, and that's when I recognised Malcolm and Eleanor Nixie.
Lord and Lady Harmdene?
As they were now called.
Yes.
We knew each other in Bruddersford years ago.
Gregory Dawson. You joined up when the war came, didn't you?
If I wanted to go forward, I had to return and explore the past fully, so I settled back and picked my way again through the years to Bruddersford and Canal Street and the Allington girls.
Gregory, have some cake.
That's Joan.
Do you play or sing, Gregory?
Eva. Golden, dreamy, smiling.
No, you're not.
And Bridget, who was a little younger, harder, and fiercely, childishly sincere.
Which one of us is it you're so keen on knowing?
Well, it's all three, really.
Your star has arrived, just flown in from Hollywood.
Liz?
She insists on coming down to see you tomorrow to talk script.
Darling,
Elizabeth!
Oh, it's so good to see you.
You said that meeting those dreary people, those Harndeans, had started you off remembering. Tell me what it's all about.
Mr. Allington? Mrs. Allington? I'm Nixie, Malcolm Nixie. This is my wife, Eleanor.
Hello, Eleanor.
Hello, Ben.
Nixie's wife, Eleanor, looking smart, excited. And Ben Kerry. Eva's adored Ben and this handsome, reckless woman from London thought of themselves now as a pair.
Happy New Year!
No!
Eva, what's the matter?
Eva?
So, Eva did know about Ben and Eleanor.
Perhaps.
Oh, poor girl.
Bright Day by J.B. Priestley. Dramatised by Diana Griffiths. Episode 2.
When I went down to lunch, Elizabeth was already in the dining room.
The Times, darling. The adverts. I'd forgotten how fascinating they are. And how marvellously English.
She was wearing enormous tortoise-shell glasses. Large enough for a Chinese philosopher.
Did you sleep well?
Not very.
Lord and Lady Harndean are waving to you.
Afternoon. Where's Brent?
He said he'd be down a bit later. He's going back to London soon.
Your pâté, madam, sir.
Thank you.
I don't know why he had to come down to Cornwall with you at all.
Well, he's one of the producers of this film. And there are things we need to talk over, obviously.
All right. I won't say another word.
Oh, Greg, why are you being so stuffy all of a sudden?
I'm just feeling fed up with Americans and their way of life.
Oh, you wouldn't have said that a few years ago, before the war. Coming back here has changed you.
Now, look, I left the States and came back in 39 to support the war effort, to write film scripts if they wanted me to. It's the only thing I can do. There weren't masterpieces and we had all kinds of difficulties to put up with. Raids, blackouts, shortages of staff, space. But they were honest-to-God jobs. You never saw any of my pictures, did you?
I might have seen one.
No, because our pictures weren't being shown in the States. We were up to our necks in the war here. And half the time we lived like rats in holes. And if people did manage to go to the pictures, what did they see? The American way of life. Yanks winning the battle for democracy and films about London taking it. A London full of dukes and toothless costermongers.
At least the Americans are alive. Half the people in this hotel are dead.
Sound like kind of American who moves between the Ritz and Claridge's and then writes articles about democracy in Britain.
Stop it. You know, Greg, we're not really arguing about Hollywood or Britain. We're just fighting. And the fight is going on somewhere behind the argument.
Very clever of you.
It's not like us. Why are we doing it?
I ought to have replied because of what happened between us last night, but I didn't. No longer friends nor lovers. We were out in no man's land, and whatever happened now, our old relationship was gone for good.
Sorry I'm late.
You're not.
Would you like the menu, sir?
Nothing for me just now, thanks. I had some calls to make. One, you'll be very interested in, Greg. I talked to Sam Grumman. You know, you are the only writer in Hollywood who ever made old Sam pay him a royalty. Technicolor's on the up, he said. So's television. The stereoscopic motion picture will be with us soon and the coast's humming with new ideas. Well, I mentioned you. Let me tell you what he's come up with. The money that's to be made, if just between
don't
us...
Don't bother.
What? The money goes
I don't
in...
care about the money.
But, Greg...
You know, Brent, I've come to the conclusion that all these fellows like Sam Grumman, the so-called bosses... just a bunch of giant parasites sucking the life out of films.
Listen, Sam Grumman wants you back. That's what he said. He's got big plans and you can be part of them. You can co-produce as well as script. You can do almost...
No! You give old Sam my love and tell him I hope to see him sometime, but I'm not going back.
Meg!
In fact, I'm never going back to Hollywood.
Now, I know just how you feel, Greg. You came back here because of the war and you've produced some nice little motion pictures under difficulties. And sometimes...
I'm staying here. That's final.
Staying to do what, Greg?
I don't know. I only know what I'm not going to do.
But you can't just turn your back on Hollywood like that.
I can do what I like. I don't have time to continue this right now. My train leaves in an hour. We'll talk again, Greg.
I expect we will.
Yeah, you will deliver the script on time.
Have I ever failed?
I'll see you both in London, then.
You never told me you decided not to go back to Hollywood.
I've only just realised it myself.
What's wrong?
I've got to get out of here. Let's go for a walk.
Slow down, thank you.
Go back, Lynn.
Where are you going?
Just walking.
You said you'd tell me everything last night.
Did I? And as the sun shone down, I went back, back to that June afternoon in 1914 at Pikeley Scar.
Greg?
Laura Blackshaw, I think she was called.
Yeah?
A 10-year-old girl. My aunt knew her parents and was looking after her for the weekend. I got saddled with taking her to the picnic.
A picnic? That would be so lovely. Oh, please, Gregory, we'll have such fun.
Come on, then. Fetch your stuff. And hurry up or we'll miss the train.
I've never been on a train before.
It was a Sunday. Not long after Whitsuntide, Mr. Allington had invited me and Jock Barniston to spend the day with the family and one or two friends up the dales at Pikeley Scar, which is a famous limestone cliff.
Are we going on that train, Gregory?
When I met Jock at Waverley Station, he was astonished to find me there with a freckle-faced little girl with two stubby ginger plaits and a miniature haversack of her own.
I think it's an excellent idea having you with us, Laura. You'll complete our party nicely. Come on, let's find some seats on the train.
Something's worrying you, Jock.
Is it?
You're not as cheerful as usual.
Well, I have to say, I'm a bit worried about Eva.
Mr. Jock, why do cows stare so much?
Well, they're not really staring. They're just thinking things over while they chew their dinners.
What are they thinking about?
Nobody knows, really.
You watch them. Try to find out, Laura.
What about Eva?
I've got a letter that Ben asked me to give her. I don't know what's in it, but he isn't coming today and she's expecting him. And I think this letter is written does a bit more than explain why he isn't coming.
Eleanor Nixie.
What?
Ben's got himself tangled up with Nixie's wife. Eva ought to forget about him. He's not worth bothering about.
Yes, he is. Even if you don't like him. There's no real harm in Ben. He's a fool at times like the rest of us, but he's just right for Eva, and she knows it. We must try to do all we can for her today.
I didn't know that anything would go badly wrong. Yet I felt I had no control over events which had their own pattern and colour outside this green and golden day. As if there was another landscape for the suffering heart, bewildered mind. Behind these bright fields, these heights of bracken and lean.
What's the matter? Why are you two so miserable?
I don't know, Laura. Something must have gone wrong with us.
Perhaps you're hungry?
Well, we're not hungry, but we think you are. A bit. We think you'd like just a little something.
You're very clever, Mr. Jock. I would like something. Shall I look in my haversack?
And as I watched Laura and the train went creeping up the dales, I felt a little less helpless. It was after 12 when we arrived at Pikeley Station. Jock led the way across the fields.
I shouldn't have brought all this stuff. 10 to 1 I'll do no painting today, yet I brought everything with me.
It was Stanley Mervyn, the old painter, carrying a lot of gear and looking hot.
Hello, love.
Hello.
And what's your name?
Laura.
Pretty name for a pretty lassie.
Thank you.
Just like to paint, Laura. Here, carry this for me.
I don't know. I've never really tried much.
But you know, Gregory, lad, I can't get to grips with this countryside. And neither can them academy chaps that comes up here with a cartload of canvas and paint. We'll give you a couple of bob for bloody lot. You can tackle this countryside best with a bit of pencil. Greys and greens and then... when the sun's bang on it, pinks that nobody believes in. You can't believe it yourself. Well, I might make a sketch or two in a while.
I'm sure you will.
If Laura will help me.
Oh, yes, please. Can I?
I always remember you saying to me, the first time we met,
that after you walked out of the wool trade and took up painting full-time, you'd been just about the happiest man in Yorkshire.
Aye. Only thing I regret is not to do what I wanted to do sooner, instead of wasting so much good time. See, lad, if you've got something in you that wants to be let out and goes on nattering at you day and night, then you let go of everything else and get it out. For that's your life. And don't let anybody tell you it isn't. And if you don't get it out, it'll go bad in you. But if you do, even if you're not for dinner but tea and bread and dripping, you're alive. And that's a damn sight more than all these chaps stinking me at brass can say.
When we arrived, they were sitting in the shade of two stunted trees, Mr. and Mrs. Allington, and Joan, Eva and Bridget. The girls wore wide, summer pastel dresses.
If you fancy them Allington girls, then go for young Bridget, the musician. That's the one that's got the right stuff in her. I dare say she'd turn on you at times like a bloody little tiger, but some chap will get a wife in 10,000 who'll go with him to hell and back. Well, here we are. Here we are. Got out to sup, John.
They jumped up and came to greet us. But then I saw Eva stop and turn away, bitterly disappointed because one of us wasn't Ben. Jock went across to her, presumably to give her the letter. I remember Joan watched them closely. After lunch, we all lazed around. Stanley Mervyn took to the shade and set up his easel, as I knew he would.
Bridget, do you want to come with Laura and me to the stream for a paddle?
Please come, Bridget.
Good idea.
As we rose to go, I heard Eva asking Jock to walk with her to the top of the scar, and they started to move off. Joan, who'd been packing away the food, started after them.
I want to come too.
Of course, Joan. Come on.
So those three took the track to the top of the cliff, and we went down the steep path to the woods and the glitter of water. Laura wandered up the stream nearer the foot of the cliff. There was a sleepy enchantment about the place where Bridget and I lingered. She was in one of her best moods. She talked about her music, I about my writing, and each of us seemed to know in a flash all that the other meant. I felt that I loved her, and that soon she might love me too. And yet, I now feel that behind the golden afternoon there was a shadow of sadness, as if we recognised remotely that we were really saying goodbye. Then Jock returned.
I left Eva and Joan sitting on that little ledge just below the top of the scar. Warm up there. Thought I'd like to cool off.
What is it, Jock? Is something wrong?
I brought a letter for Eva from Ben, telling her he's in love with somebody else.
That silly Nixie woman! How could he? I mean, think of Eva and then her.
She's taken a nasty knock, and Joan... Joan is in a bad mood.
Oh, she's only jealous because you were paying attention to Eva. You want me to go up there, don't you?
Might help.
Thank you for our talk, Gregory. I liked it very much.
They need Bridget up there. Or at least Eva does. Now, where's Laura?
Ah, she's paddling downstream.
And then the day shivered and cracked. It came from the direction of the scar, slicing through the whole afternoon and across half a dozen miles. Jock and I raced along the bank towards the scar. We passed little Laura.
Stay where you are, Laura!
I had just time to notice her face, blank, staring, all eyes in a white mask.
My God. Luke. Over there! Luke!
The crumpled pink of her dress among the rocks at the foot of the cliff looked as if strange flowers were growing there.
Come on!
I thought I saw movement, but she was dead when we reached her. At first, it was still Eva I saw, looking very young and frozen in rather foolish surprise. But after Jock and I had lifted the body onto a flat rock, it wasn't Eva, but just a body. The golden, smiling girl was gone. The next hour was screaming chaos. But little Laura stayed quiet, white-faced and staring. Somebody told me I should take her home,
So while it was all still a huddle of misery, we left to trudge in silence across the fields to the station.
There, Laura.
On the train back, the fields were as bright, the hawthorns as rich as this morning, but we were glassed in by terror and grief. The inquest determined that Eva Allington met her death by accident, having fallen from the top of Pikely Scar. The day after the funeral, we had a message at the office to say that Mr. Allington had collapsed.
Hello, Gregory.
Bridget.
Come in.
I called to see how your father is.
Oh, not much better than 2 weeks ago. Sit down, can I get you?
Nothing for me, thanks. Have you been away?
Yes, for a couple of days. Joan and I, after the funeral. Mother was busy nursing father.
Excuse me, Miss Allington, but there's Mr. and Mrs. Nixie here.
Send them in.
Bridget.
Bridget, my dear, we've come to inquire about your father.
How is Mr. Allington?
You want to know how my father is? He's very ill. And that's because my sister died. And because before that, he'd been worried for some time. And you two have done it. Between you. You came here and spoilt everything.
Now look here, young lady. You don't know what you're saying.
Oh, yes, I do. You're vile grabbers. Greedy, selfish, wicked grabbers. That's what you are. Both of you. You, Mr. Malcolm Nixie. You came here to wheedle your way in and take my father's business away from him. He was happy there before you came, and you probably don't even want it now you've got it.
The girl's hysterical. We'd better go, Malcolm.
And you, Mrs. Eleanor Nixie. You're disgusting, and you're a grabber as well. You took Ben Kerry away from Eva, just for a bit of amusement. And now Eva's dead. I don't think she wanted to live. You helped to kill her.
Oh, really? I don't see
why. Oh, now get out! Both of you!
For goodness sake.
Calm down.
Go on! And don't ever come near us again! Oh, Gregory. I had to tell them. I had to. Oh, I hate them. I hate them.
Come here. Everything you said was true. There's no need for you to be upset. It was very brave of you.
No. No, it's all stupid. Stupid. I'm going away again. I've decided.
And she did go away, somewhere to the sea. And before she returned to Brudersford, the war had arrived, and I disappeared into the army. I wrote once, but received no reply, so I didn't write again.
What became of them all?
Jock Barniston and Ben Kerry died in the war. Awful lot of men died in that war, Liz. People of my generation have been staring at gaps ever since. Allington himself died during the war.
What about the girls? I know Eva died, but what about Bridget and Joan? Did you ever meet or hear of them again?
Once. Just once. It was in the early spring of 19... I was at Victoria Station, just arrived from France. Officially, I was home on leave. But there was more than a fair chance that my demobilisation had come through and that I, Captain Gregory Dawson, was about to become a civilian once more.
Oh, sorry. Why don't you look where you're going?
I'm most awfully sorry. My fault entirely.
I should think so. It's you.
What?
Gregory Dawson.
Joan. Joan Allington. Well, I'll be...
She was teaching at a girls' boarding school somewhere in Sussex and had come up to London for the Easter holidays. Cousin had lent her a flat at Earl's Court for the duration, so she took me back there.
Cup of tea is all. There's nothing else in. Here.
Cup of tea's fine for me. Cheers.
Cheers, then. You realise, don't you, that you're the only one still alive?
I heard. I'm sorry.
I always knew Jock would be killed. I believed he knew it too. And he didn't care, you know? I don't think his life mattered to him as it did to most of us.
I know.
And I know how you felt about Jock.
Give me a cigarette, please.
What about your mother?
In Dorset. She's living with my aunt. You know, Gregory, I always liked you. Though you were a funny, awkward sort of boy when we first met. And now, I must say, you look even better than I thought you would. Uniform suits you.
She seems younger than me. As though I'd grown during the war and she had dwindled.
I'm having such a dreary existence and life is so horribly different now with everybody gone. Gregory.
Yes?
Dearest Gregory. I was nice to you when you were just a lonely boy dying to know us, wasn't I? Well, it's your turn now. Oh, I know this is the wrong way to talk to
it's
a man.
It's all right, Joan. Tell me. What do you want me to do?
Take me out tonight. I want some fun, and I can't bear it if you go away now and leave me here. Just for tonight, Gregory. Please.
So we went out, for drinks first, then to dinner, where she was a bit feverish and slightly embarrassing. Then we took in a show, which I didn't enjoy. It was one of those big, rowdy reviews, with the chorus girls swarming all over the gangways and half-tight profiteers in the stalls waving rattles and women with heavily powdered white faces so they looked like embittered clowns. The whole thing devised to prevent a single thought entering the heads of anyone there. No wit, no real fun, no art. This greedy rabble didn't seem worth the life of one stammering Lance Corporal. We'd thrown away the best, only to keep and fatten the worst. The struggle was over. Democracy was saved. Here was Merry England. So this was our famous after the war, was it? Joan's eyes were shining with excitement, and I did my best to smile back.
Can we go to a nightclub now?
I had to force myself to remember that this was one of the magical girls I used to long to get to know.
Oh, I want to dance and dance.
The Joan Allington I had walked with and talked with in a sunlight that seemed to have vanished from this earth.
And you'll come back and stay with me at the flat tonight.
But if you want me to?
I didn't want her. There might be somebody else I wanted, but not her. Now she seemed just a girl, any girl I'd picked up for a night out. One of us, or both, must have changed a lot during the last 5 years.
I've had such a wonderful time. It was perfect. And you were so sweet to me all evening. It wasn't like being with somebody I just got to know, because you belonged to the happy time before the war. And that's what made it so especially wonderful. Oh, Gregory, love me.
No, Joan, stop it, stop it. Sit down.
What? Why? Don't you like me?
Yes, of course I do, but take it easy. I'm just rather tired. But,
But what?
What you said.
Said?
About the time before the war, Brudersford and your father, Jock, Eva.
Eva? Why should we talk about Eva?
I never really understood. I mean, about what really happened. I heard your evidence read out at the inquest, but I knew that ledge on Pikely Scar, and what you said about Eva slipping didn't seem to make much sense.
What are you saying?
I'm only asking. I've often wondered, but I didn't like to say anything at the time. How...
You were like all the others, even Jock. You all thought Eva was wonderful just because she was so pretty. But she was awfully stupid, really. She wouldn't believe for ages about Ben Kerry being in love with that woman. And then when he told her outright in that letter Jock brought that he'd finished with her, she just hadn't anything left. I kept telling her not to be a fool, and there was Jock making a fuss of her, and you'd have done the same if you had the chance. I remember the way you looked at her. Oh, yes, I remember.
All right, Joan, don't go on and on. The point is, I imagine that she didn't care what happened, and so she slipped off.
No, she didn't.
What?
If you must know, she threw herself off. I couldn't stop her. She just rushed to the edge and went. She did, Gregory. She did.
She did. Oh, she did. She did. She did.
I left very early in the morning, before she was stirring, and I never saw Joan Allington again. And there ends all my memories of the Allingtons.
But didn't she... Wait, didn't she say anything about Bridget?
Bridget?
The musician. Didn't you ask her?
Well, yes. She told me she was married to an Irishman.
She was married to an Irishman called Connolly, Michael Connolly. One of those dark Irishmen with blue eyes. Very fascinating and charming. Utterly charming. You know the type who survives solely on their charm. She adores him. They live in Ireland just outside Dublin. But it won't work. You'll see.
I don't suppose I shall see.
You wrote to her once, didn't you?
Never got a reply.
She said something to me about it. She thought that if she replied and then you went on writing to each other, it might mean more to you than it meant to her. See, she wasn't sure what she felt about you. When Michael came along, it was very different. She just fell flat and adored him.
I'm not surprised with all that charm. And after all, Joan, I never pretended to be very fascinating.
That's all she said. I think she was trying to make me jealous. So I played the opposite.
I see. What's the time?
What? It's 3 o'clock. Where are you going?
I've just got time to pack and catch the early evening train back to London.
But why?
Oh, Greg, it has become quite clear to me that behind all this remembering of yours is a simple fact, obvious to any woman, that when you were a boy, you fell in love with a girl.
What girl?
Bridget, of course.
Bridget? It's 32 years since I set eyes on her.
Yes, when you fell in love with her by the stream. And, deep down, unbeknown to you, you've stayed in love with her ever since.
I don't believe it. That's much too simple. Look, I may have been fascinated, held in a kind of spell by a certain quality of life.
No. You just stayed in love with her and you didn't know it. And that explains a lot of things about you, Greg. Remember, I asked if you'd fallen in love with somebody because things were so different between us. I mean, we haven't really been together since I arrived. We haven't even been the friends we were years ago in Hollywood. And your refusing to go back to Hollywood is part of it.
No,
don't say anything or I shall cry, and I don't want to do that. I mean, you couldn't really bother about me, you see, because you were so busy remembering. I think a lot of important stuff has come out and you're discovering part of yourself. Well, no, Greg, don't interrupt. And if it wasn't for Bridget, you'd never have started thinking about that miserable Lord Harndean and his wife. You wouldn't have thought they were worth 5 minutes of your attention.
Liz.
No, don't. It's better this way now. There's a lot to do and Brent is organising a big cocktail party for me, so I'm leaving. Do you think you'll miss me, Greg?
I know I shall. And all the more because I didn't make the most of you while you were here.
Now, don't bother about seeing me off. When we go back, just go straight to your room and finish the script. We'll meet in a few days in London anyway.
I worked solidly on the script until mid-evening to stave off the melancholy. Over dinner, the Harndeans, or should I say the Nixies, had smiled and waved across at me, and I realised I'd never really talked to them, in particular Eleanor, about what she had called the good old days. Now that I had done remembering, the time felt right. I found her alone in the lounge, finishing her coffee.
May I join you?
Oh, please do. I'm afraid Malcolm has gone off to play bridge. We're away back to London tomorrow.
It was you I wanted to speak to. If I can come straight to the point.
It's about Bradersford?
Yes. Cigarette?
Thank you. Your friend Miss Earle told me when we were playing poker last night that you were busy brooding over your distant past. She asked me what you were like then, and I said you were a rather clever, cheeky boy who obviously thought Malcolm and I were a pair of rather sinister interlopers. Like the furious child who denounced us, do you remember?
Bridget, yes. You see, the Allington family used to be happy. But a lot of unfortunate things happened to them after you and your husband arrived and he succeeded in taking over the business.
I see. They were happy before we appeared, eh?
Yes, I think they were. And I know that I was happy with them. In fact, I've never felt like that about a family since.
I've never felt it about any family at any time, but then I don't like families. And what happened to those Allingtons was no worse than what happened to millions of other families all over Europe. And they're not the only people who suffered.
But if you remember...
Oh, but I do. You know, Mr. Dawson, you are not the only person here with a memory. We're leaving in the morning, so I'm going to tell you something now that no one else knows. Mm-hmm. It's all ancient history, but we might as well get it straight. You still think, as that Allington child said that night, that I deliberately took Ben Kerry away from her sister for a little amusement, just grabbed him to pass the time, don't you?
Well,
but you're quite wrong. It wasn't like that at all.
Look, I really don't want
to... That's the kind of thing I might easily have done at that time, but this was quite different. You see, I was in love with Ben. It was the first and last time I ever was in love. That girl, or any other girl of that age, couldn't possibly have begun to understand what I felt about him. I was ready to give up everything for him. When he was killed, just after we spent his last leave together, I thought I'd go mad. And I've never forgotten a single second of the time Ben and I spent together. That's why I said you weren't the only person here with a memory. Good night, Mr. Dawson.
During the next few days, with nobody in the hotel I wanted to talk to, and with no more remembering to be done, I tore into the last two sequences of The Lady Hits Back. Probably I worked all the better because I felt so bored and empty when I wasn't working. Then late, on my final evening...
Hello.
Gregory, darling.
You sound very pleased with yourself, Liz.
Oh, and you sound very cross. Brent said you were happy with the script.
Oh, it's all right.
When will you be coming to London?
I'll catch the afternoon train tomorrow.
Perfect. For two reasons, darling. Listen, first, Brent's cocktail party for me at Claridge's is on Thursday, and you must be there. And the other thing is, could you come and see me at the Dorchester on Wednesday at, say, tea time? It's very important.
All right, yes, yes, I can come.
Wednesday, then. Good night, darling, good night.
I went back to work and stuck at it until I reached the final fade-out. This was about 2:30 in the morning. The Lady Hits Back was finished, and with it, a whole chapter of my life. It hadn't been a bad life, but now I knew quite definitely I had done with it. I was growing old. And if I had anything to say, I wanted to be able to say it at last, in my own way. So, farewell, exquisite, lovely, glamorous lady. And for Elizabeth's sake, Brent's sake, all our sakes, I hope on your release and in your progress around the world that you won't gross less than 250,000 sterling. Be a big success, darling lady, and goodbye forever.
Darling, come in.
She looked exotic in a corn-coloured suit and an absurd tall hat blazing with scarlet feathers.
I'm so excited.
You're going to tell me what this is all about?
You'll very soon see.
I had delivered the script to Brent that morning, then come on to the Dorchester.
In here, Gregory.
She showed me into her sitting room. There was a little middle-aged woman on the settee. I couldn't see her face because she was wearing a shapeless old felt hat. I thought she was there to inquire about some sewing.
Sit down, won't you?
Then the woman lifted her head and I saw her face. Bridget Allington!
I have to go out for an hour or so, but I'm sure neither of you will mind about that. Have a lovely talk.
This is a great surprise.
Yes, it is. I suppose I'd better pour out.
Yes. How did Miss Earle, how did she get hold of you?
Telephone directory. I live in London now, so it was easy. Oh.
I met Joan years ago and she told me you'd got married and gone to live in Ireland. Mm. I want to know all about it, but first, tell me, what happened to Joan?
She died about 10 years ago. She became... Well, she was rather unbalanced and had to stop teaching. She used to take a lot of things to make her sleep. But they said it was her heart in the end.
I'm sorry.
I never really understood her.
And what's been happening to you?
Oh, we had three children. Michael, Sheila and...
Her story came out as a series of replies to my questions. The marriage to Connolly wasn't much good, though she didn't say so. And he had died several years previously. Bridget had kept herself and the family going by playing in orchestras, giving lessons, cooking, mending and nursing.
I still give lessons, but I don't play anymore. It's Sheila's the true musician. She's studying at the Royal Academy. You never married?
Somehow I never got round to it. I met the Nixies recently, and they got me thinking about Bruddersfield.
Yes, Miss Earle said so.
I might as well have said I'd taken up salmon fishing, but I persisted. I was talking to them about that Sunday evening when your father was ill, and they called, and you told them what you thought of them. You can't have forgotten.
No, I haven't. But I can't imagine why you think it's worth bothering about now. I was very young.
The reason I mentioned it is that Eleanor Nixie told me something surprising. She didn't take Ben Kerry away from Eva out of devilment, as we thought. She was madly in love with him.
From what I remember of her, she couldn't have been madly in love with anybody except herself.
No, I think she was telling me the truth. You see, Joan told me, when we met that last time, that Eva hadn't fallen off Pikely Scar by accident, but had deliberately thrown herself off.
Oh, rubbish. Joan would say anything if she felt like it and wanted to attract your attention. You know, you never understood what Joan was really like. In fact, I don't think you really understood any of us. We often used to laugh at you. I don't mean we disliked you or anything like that. But I suppose you were a lonely boy, rather sentimental and romantic, and you enjoyed making things up because you wanted to be a writer, of course. You wrote to me once after you joined the army and I didn't reply. That's the main reason why I didn't, because you never saw us as we really were. I've just remembered that, although I haven't given it much thought for years and years. I've had too much to do to bother about what's happened when I was in my teens. It's not important.
Oh, but it is important. It is. What you were then and all that happened to you after have made you what you are now. The same with me. But you, Bridget Ellington, at some point, probably when the war came and your father died, you stopped looking back because you daren't. It was all in a ruin.
I don't understand what you mean. It's over 30 years and we don't really know each other. I'm quite different now, naturally.
Naturally?
I'm not sure you are. I think you're still just making things up. Probably, being a writer, you can't help it.
There may be something in that. That evening, I wandered around going nowhere, seeing nothing, mixing amongst the crowds, the lighted box offices, the restaurants, as if I were a ghost. I felt finished and done for. I'd gone back to my youth, to the Ellingtons and Bruddersfield, on some daft treasure hunt that I'd never really understood and had come out empty-handed. I drifted away from Elizabeth. I didn't want Hollywood, didn't want Brent. And I was still dead, perhaps even a bit deader, the following afternoon when I haunted Brent's cocktail party at Claridge's. Everyone was there, representatives of the British film industry, the press, those people who were invited to everything.
Darling. Oh. Have you got a drink?
Someone's getting me one.
I simply had to tell you. Brent sent round the final sequences for me to read at lunchtime. And, Craig, you are marvellous. You really are. I've done nothing but argue and argue about scripts since you left Hollywood, but this one is perfect. I am so grateful.
I mumbled something, but I wanted to say, look, Liz, I feel empty and miserable and bang up against a blank wall. You don't owe me any kindness, but I need some. So walk straight out of here with me and then let's talk quietly. She must have noticed.
Don't go, Greg. Most of these people will have gone soon, and Brent and I and one or two others are dining here.
Oh, no, you pop off, Liz. I'm going. I'm glad you like the script.
Greg.
It was goodbye, and we both knew it. One of us was waving from the ship's rail and the other from the receding quay. I turned away.
Oh, sorry. Dawson.
Is it time, destiny, chance, or God keeps shuffling the pack and laying out the cards?
If only we could step back far enough to look at the changing pattern, because I'd bump straight into...
Lord Harndean. So you're here as well, are you?
Got an invitation from that fellow Brent. Eleanor's in there somewhere. She loves these dudes. But you're just the man I want, Dawson. I tried to get you on the phone.
Let's go down here, out of the noise.
I'm on a committee, you see. Well, I'm on several, actually. Dealing with conditions of women's employment, amongst other things. Anyway, I attended a meeting yesterday, and I was talking to a woman there, a Mrs. Childs, who represents some of the important women's trade unions. One of those earnest socialist types she is. You know them. Well, she was asking me if I knew any film people. I mentioned meeting you down in Cornwall and so on, and she got all excited and gave me her number and asked me to pass it on to you should I see you again. Oh. Here. She wants you to ring her.
I see.
I must go and find my wife. You must have dinner with us one night.
Even he, who'd never lived at all, was doing more than me. I didn't know what to do with myself. And so, with nothing better to do...
Hello? Mrs. Child speaking.
Oh, hello. My name's Dawson, Gregory Dawson. Lord Harndean told me you wanted to talk to me, something to do with films.
Gregory Dawson? Oh yes, I certainly do. It's really very important. I'm so glad you've rung.
I warn you that if it's because you've got a beautiful niece who wants to be a famous film star...
What? No, nothing like that. No beautiful nieces. It's just that... Well... We're discussing the foundation of a new film group. Quite a big thing. I've got some film people, mostly young, keen technicians from the film industry, coming here tonight for an informal meeting. And I wondered, I know it might seem like a lot to ask, but would you possibly join us?
Well, I don't know. I'm just a cynical old motion picture hack, you know, Mrs. Childs.
I know all about you, Mr. Dawson, and what you've done, and you're just the person we need.
She was about 40, with reddish hair. She hurried me straight into her sitting room, which was filled with smoke and with young people all sprawling around on the floor and over the furniture. I recognised one of the noisiest as a lad called Hinchcliffe, who had been working for Brent as chief cutter.
Mr. Dawson, good to see you, sir. Marvellous. Quiet, everybody, quiet. Turn it up. Look who's here. This is Gregory Dawson, the bloke we all wanted.
I was given the largest chair, two fierce-looking young women perched on the arms of it. Mrs. Childs spoke first, and what I heard brought me an agreeable surprise.
I've been worried about the kind of films our people see. The outlook and values of these films are all wrong.
Absolutely.
It's not that we want films to be so much political and economic propaganda, but we do feel that the screen should show how real people behave in a real world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, if a new producing unit was organised, ready to work along these lines, I'm sure the necessary capital would follow. And I'm also sure that some of the unions would put all their weight behind the task of distributing these films.
Hinchcliffe then took over.
A great many of our best younger technicians are tired of helping to produce mischievous nonsense, and I can guarantee more than an adequate staff of good cameramen, sound men, cutters and the rest. We know that no new studio...
Then it was my turn.
Any writers here tonight?
Over here, sir.
Yeah.
Good. Now, I've argued for years that the basis of good filmmaking is first a soundly constructed story. Because if the story is bad, then all the acting and directing and fancy camera work in the world won't amount to anything.
Yes.
Get rid of Hollywood values by all means. But Hollywood techniques now. Don't throw them all out. Smooth continuity, glossy finish on the job, visuals and sound that'll stand up to poor small-town projectors. Keep as much of them as you can until you've found something better. As you will, of course, in time.
Thank you.
Don't expect too much.
No, you're going for a pint.
A little often.
Later, when they had left, Mrs. Childs, Hinchcliffe and I sat around for a summing up.
I heard this morning... You've just turned down a big offer to go back to Hollywood, Mr. Dawson.
That's right.
I hope you don't mind my asking. But what are you going to do?
I don't mind you asking. And the answer is, I don't know.
Is there any particular reason?
Oh, I've been at it a long time, and I'm feeling rather bored and stale. It's a long story.
Why don't you come in with us? I mean, you'd make all the difference. You've had just the experience the rest of us haven't had. I know we can't offer you anything like the money.
Never mind the money. Most of it goes on tax anyway. What have you got to offer apart from that?
Anything. You can produce, direct, find new directors, new stars, write, show others what to write, do whatever you like. I have to go. I promised I wouldn't be late. You talk to him, Mr. Charles. Give him the works. No, don't move. I'll see myself out.
It's late, and you must be tired. Perhaps I ought to...
Oh, no, don't go. I'm not sleepy. Would you like some tea? I'm afraid I haven't anything stronger to offer.
While she was in the kitchen, I began trying to decide what to say to her. My mind was confused, uncertain, but I was starting to feel alive again. She wasn't pretty at all, couldn't even vaguely be called handsome. But there might be times when people who knew her well would think her beautiful, in a strong way, rich in thought and experience.
Lord Harndean said he'd probably meet you at a grand cocktail party at Claridge's. I was wondering what you'd think of this noisy gang here after all that.
I not only liked it all, but it did me a lot of good to be amongst them. They've got something to offer, something new and fresh.
Good. I'm glad you feel like that, because it's my job to persuade you to join us.
You're working late, aren't you? Long past union hours.
It's worth it. Look, what you said to Hinchcliffe earlier, refusing Hollywood offers, feeling bored and stale. If you don't mind my saying so, I've been wondering what's been happening to you.
So have I. But it's too long to go into. I've been remembering my past, and it's taken the taste and colour out of my present. I feel like a weary old ghost.
Come over here, into the light. See this? Do you recognise it?
It's a painting, a watercolour.
Look at it more closely now.
And then I was staring through a little window at another world. At a bright morning lost forever until tears blurred my eyes.
I've been out since early on, having a go at that little bridge at Broadstone Beck End.
Here was the glinting stream. The stone arch of the bridge in the morning sunlight. The moors and the hills. Stanley Mervyn.
And if I've had one try at that little beggar, I've had a dozen. Never could get bloody tone right, but I think I've got it this time.
This was the very same watercolour that he showed Jock and me at the White Horse pub on that first Sunday we went out together. He just painted it that morning.
It's a little miracle.
It's all that's left of that great gold Maytime. Jock striding out like an Indian. The cool bar of the pub. Ellington's at their cottage. Eva Joan and Bridget. And the cricket we played on the green. Another world and another time. All gone. Lost. Forgotten.
Not forgotten. And it's the same world. Even that little bridge is still there. I saw it last summer. But you must stop going back like that. It's the wrong way. I felt like you when I lost my husband 10 years ago. We'd been very happy together and it was for such a short time and I said, lost, everything, gone. Until I made myself stop. Made myself realise that life goes on. And if people die and things change, that's all part of it. And the worst thing to do is to turn your face away and hold yourself rigid and not let life go flowing through you. Do you see what I mean, Gregory?
Who are you?
I knew you once, a long time ago. You won't remember.
There's something about your eyes. When I first came in, I recognised it. And the way you smile. You're Laura, aren't you?
I was only 10.
Little Laura Blackshaw.
And you never saw me again after that dreadful Sunday at Pikely Scar.
Oh, Laura. Hey. Laura, Laura, Laura.
I used to follow you around in the most shameless manner. I thought you were wonderful. And you were so sweet to me for a boy of, what, 18?
Mm.
And I adored you for years afterwards. I was so happy to be with you and your friend Jock in the train. But I think it took me years to get over the rest of it.
And then I told her about meeting Joan, and her telling me about Eva committing suicide.
Joan? What became of that one?
She died some years ago.
Gregory, there's something...
What?
I'm past 40 now, and I was only 10 then. It's hard to believe it could matter after all this time, but it does. I suppose it's because I bottled it up and pretended to forget about it. Gregory. That afternoon at Pagley Scar. It's something I've never told anybody. But you've been thinking about that time, and it was you who looked after me and comforted me, and now I feel I ought to tell you.
Yes?
You remember, I'd wandered away from you and Bridget. And from where I was, I could see those two, Eva and Joan, on that ledge. I could even hear their voices, although I couldn't tell what they were saying. And then they began quarrelling, and I watched them. I saw Eva slap Joan's face, and then Joan flew at her, I tried so hard to pretend that I hadn't seen it. That somehow I just made it up, but I did see it. Joan pushed Eva off the ledge. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't think it... I'd be so stupid, but I can't help it.
So that's the truth of it. She must have done it because of Jock, because he was giving Eva all the attention. She must have always been a bit mad. Oh, blast the Allingtons. Oh, there now, Laura. Come on. Come on, lads. You've told me everything, and it's all over and done with.
I was only saying something like that to you a few minutes ago.
Well, that's how it is. People have to keep on saying these sensible things to each other. Sometimes it's your turn, sometimes it's mine. Even my old chum Malcolm Nixie, your Lord Harndean, has his moments.
Why do you say that?
Back in Cornwall, I found myself up against a great black wall with no peepholes and no way through or round. And then this evening, up popped Harndean and gave me a card with your number on it. That card was a crack in the wall showing a glimmer of light.
Do you think you'll join our film venture?
Yes, if you really want me to.
Badly. We do need you badly.
Then we'll have a thundering good try. I'm going now. You're tired. But this lovely watercolour of old Stanley Mervyn's. How did you come across it?
His wife gave it to me. When I was at college, I used to go and stay in their cottage during the summer holidays.
He gave me some advice that last time I met him, that Sunday when Eva died. But I never took it. After the war, I thought I knew too much to remember any advice from old Yorkshire painters. By then, I thought I knew it all.
I'll see you out.
Yes. Is there any chance of you dining with me tomorrow, Laura?
Yes, I'd like that.
Good. It was a fine night with a glimmer of stars through thin moving veils of cloud. In my mind was a little brilliantly illuminated stage on which ideas paraded and capered. And all around the stage, where timeless eyes watched in the shadows, was an atmosphere of solemn tenderness for life. I hadn't known that mood, that theatre of creation, for years and years. Something good might come of it.
If you've got something in you that wants to be let out and goes on nattering at you day and night, then you let go of everything else and get it out. For that's your life, lad. And don't let anybody tell you it isn't.
In the final part of Bright Day by J.B. Priestley, Gregory Dawson and the narrator was played by Jack Shepherd, Elizabeth Earle by Liza Sadovy, young Gregory, Dean Smith, Joan Allington, Sarah Smart, Bridget Allington, Sarah Cherm, Eva Allington, Lowry Evans, Jock and Hafner, Conrad Nelson, Malcolm Nixey, Fred Ridgway, Eleanor Nixey, Janice McKenzie, Mr. Allington, David Fleischman, Mr. Ackworth, Finetime Fontaine, Brent and Stanley Mervyn, Seamus O'Neill, Ben Kerry, Steve Marsh, Laura Blackshaw, Megan Winard, Mrs. Childs, Owen May, and Hinchcliffe, Jake Norton. It was dramatised by Diana Griffiths and produced and directed by Pauline Harris.
The Untold Tales from Beyond the Village.
I spent so long trying to cling on to what we had.
Can't you try to forgive me now?
It's too late, Ian.
Why?
Because...
If you knew...
Because I can't. All I asked was for you to be honest and you couldn't even give me that.
The story continues away from Ambridge.
I do love you, Matt. I always have.
Ambridge Extra. Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 2:15 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Well, Mel Gedroych has a packed hour on the way, and after that, I'll be back with today's Tea Time Comedy Hour, starting with Beachcomber. Join me then, if you can.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello and a happy Friday to you. Yes, I'm doing the Friday dance. I do it every Friday. It's Mel Gedroych here with the 4 o'clock show. And I just want to warn you, it's going to be a bit of a wet one today. So I'm just running through a checklist of equipment that we might need. OK, right. Goggles? Check. Pair of flippers? Tick. Snorkel? Check. All-in-one shark repellent wetsuit with anti-piranha protective gloves? Check. Yes. We're going to need all of the above as we'll be getting up close and personal with some real denizens of the deep.
Oh, and it's taken the bait right in front of me. It's huge. It's swimming away from me now. That's amazing. Nobody was ready for it on deck. It took the whole tuna. Dear, that gave me a jump.
Today's show's all about diving with dangerous beasts as we hear the final episode of this week's exciting story, The Boy Who Swam with Piranhas, written and read by David Armand.
Many make their way in hushed excitement to a place that seems more still than any other. A place where a simple wheeled trailer stands with a tarpaulin draped across its front, bearing the simple words, Stanley Potts.
Stay tuned to find out whether Stanley takes his big leap into the unknown. Talking of leaps, we'll also hear about the late, great Annette Kellerman, the lady known as the Diving Venus.
A form of entertainment that she kind of invented, it combined her skills in diving, swimming and ballet. And she adopted this persona of a kind of mermaid.
So, if you're ready, let's dive on in. Luckily, we're not going to need our swimming kit for today's magical mystery tour, although the place we're going does have a marvellous coastline. Well, let's get the ball rolling with a musical clue. Can you tell where we're heading from this?
I know a place where the grass is really greener.
The music fans among you might be able to make a connection from that little burst of music.
I know a place where the grass is really greener.
Don't worry if you're drawing a blank, as there are lots more clues still to come.
This is a moment of truth, announces Pancho Pirelli. The crowd quietens. You see it before you, says Pancho, a boy who was raised by the shores of the Orinoco. We see what, says Ernie. Will this extraordinary boy dance with the piranhas, says Pancho. Will he what, says Annie? Or will he be gobbled up before your very eyes?
Today in our story, The Boy Who Swam with Piranhas, young Stanley Potts attempts to perform the incredible feat of swimming with flesh-eating piranhas. Well, rather you than me, Stanley. Yet Stanley's not the only one happy to get up close and personal with a deadly fish. Take naturalist Mark Cowardine, for example. In the following programme, Mark takes a deep breath and drops beneath the waves near Guadalupe in Mexico to go in search of an animal with the biggest teeth in the ocean. the great white shark.
And I'm in. Well, I'm finally in the cage and staring out into the deep blue. Now, all I can see are not what you might expect, but two dead tuna hanging from bait lines, big tuna, which we hope will attract the sharks. Now, one problem is the visibility naturally is good here, but they've been chumming from the boat, so while the cook has been preparing our breakfast, the rest of the crew have been preparing the shark's breakfast. And they've got a big barrel load of blood, fish guts, there's all sorts of bits of dead...